Okay, well, I was talking to a comrade in the bar before, and she said, globalisation of the nation state, isn't that past? And when you think war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan, kind of war on Libya, bailouts of banks and financial institutions and corporations all around the world, the whole question about the nation state, oh, that's sort of like, that's over now, isn't it? Yeah, well, you could see why she might have thought it was a bit of a non-question. But there are still a lot of things, I think, that these arguments really surfaced around the left in the 90s. They gained a lot of traction at the time of the anti-capitalist movement that sort of was launched on an international scale with the WTO protests in Seattle in November 1999. So I want to go through basically the arguments and then some of the, well, the evidence, I think, that undermines the arguments that globalisation and the nation state are sort of things of the past, and then to talk about some of the political implications that come out of this. So what's the basic argument? And again, it's an argument that's been around since the 1990s, and in a lot of ways the form of it hasn't changed much. The idea that the world economy has reached a new stage in which governments and workers alike are virtually powerless to withstand the depredations of internationalised capitalism. This new stage is supposed to have happened because of a growing internationalisation of both production and of marketing. Companies, it is said in this analysis, are much more dependent than ever before on their ability to sell abroad in the face of global competition. And any of you who work or have worked for businesses that are involved in this global competition will probably have heard this from your bosses, that we've got to compete, global competitiveness, it's the order of the day and so on. In order to do this, then more and more corporations are pushing towards becoming multinational corporations, that they're organising production on an international scale and they're ignoring national borders, so the argument goes. This then means that they're able to escape any control by national states or by workers' movements that operate within those nation states. They're free to move their capital to wherever labour is cheapest, thus thwarting workers' attempts to defend wages and conditions through trade union action. Again, these arguments are probably familiar to you all. Now, not surprisingly, neoliberal proponents of free market capitalism like these arguments. They insist that the new global order rules out any attempt to regulate the system, except during a global financial crisis, of course, when, of course, the degree of regulation in their interest was, of course, well, that's just absolutely necessary and no one could possibly object to it. And therefore, they make an attack on even the mildest reforms, things like a minimum wage, a shorter working week, any attempt to protect jobs against recession. All of these are just impossible in the current era of globalised capitalism. And there's a warning, of course, that comes from these proponents of global capitalism that if workers push their demands too hard, then companies in the new globalised environment will simply pack up and move elsewhere. And they make a similar argument about governments, that if governments implement meaningful reforms, if they had, you know, environmental protection legislation with any teeth, for example, then new investment would simply flow to the more profitable, less regulated parts of the world. So the conclusion of their argument is that all that governments can or should do is to enact policies which will make their particular group of workers more productive, more cost-efficient than those elsewhere in the world, or to make laws which would enable one government to outbid others in guaranteeing profitability. That is, you know, the governments are still allowed to do some things. They can have corporate tax cuts, they can have anti-union laws, they can implement austerity measures as we're seeing all around the world at the moment as the capitalist class attempts to make workers pay for the economic crisis. But the argument about globalisation, even though it's pretty obvious when you state it like this, the usefulness of this argument for the proponents of capitalism, for those who think that capitalism is a great system. On the other hand, the argument about globalisation has had an impact on those who don't want to celebrate capitalism but who want to resist it. And you can go back really until the 1980s to see some of these arguments. Nigel Harris, who actually had been previously not just a member of the International Socialists in Britain but was the editor for a whole period of the International Socialism Journal, had, in the process of kind of giving up on revolutionary politics, started to draw this analysis of the where global capitalism was going in order to draw very pessimistic conclusions. And this is what he said. A single global labour market, moving towards one price for labour for each skill grade, regardless of whether the countries are more or less developed. This implies that groups of workers in different countries compete with each other for employment, offering employers the lowest price at a given level of labour productivity. And this is the kicker. The power of trade unions to influence this bargain in the international context hardly exists at all. So you can see that the implications obviously are not just for those who want to say, well, this is how it is and unions and governments can have no impact anymore because we're all globalised, but for those who actually do want to resist, there can be very pessimistic conclusions drawn out of this analysis of how the world has developed. And I think the more that trade union leaders take up this approach and remember the xenophobic corollaries that go with it, then the less they focus on the neoliberal assault on wages, jobs and welfare that is not going on somewhere else in the globe but under their very noses. So that's basically the argument, globalisation and the nation state, that globalisation has taken place, production has changed, and therefore all of the things that we used to rely on, class struggle and so on, to try and change the world, that these things fundamentally undermined. Well, fortunately, there is a counter-argument. And this view of footloose capital going wherever it likes around the globe doesn't really fit reality. And I want to go through and actually look at some of the evidence. And I have to say that there's an excellent book which I brought with me that somewhere. Anyway, called New Capitalism by a guy called Kevin Dugan. I don't know anything about Kevin Dugan. He's an academic of some kind and he seems like some kind of left winger. But he's written a book, part of which actually deals with the facts and figures, very up-to-date ones, in relation to trying to refute this argument about that the world's all globalised and, you know, we can't really do anything about anything anymore. But I want to begin by looking a bit historically at things. There is nothing new about the international character of capitalism. Any of you who have read the Communist Manifesto, for example, will remember that phrase, the need for a constantly expanding market chases the bourgeoisie over the whole surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. Well, when Marx wrote that, that process was at its beginning, but it was available to those who chose to look, even in 1848 when the Communist Manifesto was published. And so the search for markets as far across the world as possible, the movement of funds across state boundaries, have been a characteristic of capitalism from its origins. And that's the process that we see expanding and continuing today. But there are some important qualifications, I think, that need to be made about what's actually happening with how this process of internationalisation is going on. Because, again, if you listen to the myth of globalisation, you'd think that, well, there's trade everywhere, there's exports everywhere, that no company is attached to any particular nation and all this sort of stuff. And that's actually very far from the case. Exports remain a minority of all production. The vast majority of output today is for markets within the countries where it's produced. More significant still has been the growth in foreign direct investment. Between 1990 and 2003, foreign direct investment accounted for 8% of world investment. In the US, the world's largest economy, it accounted for 7% of total investment. So investment in the domestic economy vastly dwarfs investment in the internationalised economy. The globalisation orthodoxy paints a picture of capital flowing evenly across the face of the earth in search of lower wages, higher profits, with production facilities springing up uniformly across all five continents. Not what's actually happening. In fact, the real picture of the location of capital is very different to this kind of neoliberal dream. Almost all the major multinationals tend to invest more in one country than in any other. General Motors, for example, has 2/3 of its assets, sales and workforce based in the United States. It's a major multinational corporation, but most of it is in the US. Kevin Dugan's book gives an interesting an index, what he calls the transnationality index, of the top 100 transnational corporations. And the transnationality index, which is how much of their operations, workforce and so on are in a single country compared to countries elsewhere, the average for the top 100 is around 50%. So in other words, for many of the top 100 multinationals, the domestic production, domestic arrangements, domestic employment and so on remains the key. And this becomes even clearer when we look at the minority of multinationals, which have internationalized much more than that average, because they have a common characteristic. They are generally those that are based in the smaller European countries, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Sweden, and so on. In other words, the ones that are most likely to have internationalized more and have less of their production and so on in a single domestic base are the ones whose domestic base is little. It kind of stands to reason. And further, the largest multinationals do not invest evenly across the globe. Most trade and investment is not major advanced economies like the United States investing in the most poverty-stricken countries in Africa. Far from it. Most trade investment is between the advanced countries. And again, if we look at total foreign direct investment, which reached a high point in 2000, 80% of foreign direct investment was in or between advanced economies in 2000. And this process, far from globalisation, meaning that this process is going away, actually, the amount of investment that goes into the advanced economies, between the advanced economies, has increased in exactly the period when the argument about globalisation and footloose capital spreading all over the globe, when that argument has been growing between 1980 and 2006, I have the figures. At that very point that the arguments have been growing, the facts have been going in the opposite direction. So the share of foreign direct investment in or between advanced economies between 1980 and 2006 increased from 56% to 70% of foreign direct investment. So far from there being a homogenous global arena for investment, nearly two-thirds of the world is virtually written off the map as far as direct investment is concerned. One figure that I think, you know, encapsulates all of this. In 2005, Britain was the single largest recipient of inward investment. Britain, that well-known backward country. It got 18% of the total of foreign direct investment, which was 5.5 times as much as all of Africa got. So I think this is quite an indication that globalisation is not all about footloose capital just going anywhere and everywhere all over the globe. The bulk of investment from firms in one country is concentrated in that and adjacent countries. And in fact, I think the British Marxist Chris Harman suggests that we're not seeing global integration, but in fact much more regional integration would be a better description of what's happening within the North African, Japanese and European parts of the advanced industrial worlds. Okay, well, I want to move on to say a little bit about the multinational corporations because, you know, they're the bad guys, and for Marxists, they are the bad guys. All corporations are the bad guys. So a little bit about globalisation, what globalisation common sense says about multinationals. Well, it stresses the relentless rise of multinationals, which it depicts as roaming the world, again, seeking the cheapest place for investment in each stage of production processes. And, as I said before, in separation from any allegiance to any particular nation state. Now, in fact, there have been changes in production over the last century and a half. The way in which capitalism organises production is not some uniform thing. You think about the 19th century, the early years of capitalism, you know, confined to a few places in Europe at the time. Industries were a multitude of small producing units. By the end of the 19th and early 20th century, there'd begun to be, through process of competition and therefore concentration and centralisation of capital, there'd been concentration into trusts and cartels and a shift to world market competition. And while the early multinationals tended either to be based on extracting raw materials from the third world for manufacture in the West, the oil companies are a good example of that, or on the ownership of foreign subsidiaries which were involved in completely local production. So the initial way in which, as capitalism became, the units of capital became larger and larger and began to spread more around the world, they tended to operate in these ways, either sourcing raw materials or setting up subsidiaries that then produced for a local market somewhere else in the world. And this remained the picture right through until the late 1960s, when there was a restructuring of industry in ways that did cut much more across national boundaries. The whole idea of global production, probably best typified for those of you who's not that many of you here old enough to remember this, the idea of the world car. And the world car was this idea that this was going to be the exemplar of globalised production. And we have some aspects of this in a range of sort of things, but the world car kind of, the image was that every aspect of the car would be sourced from a plant in a different country, and assembly would take place in a range of different places. So it would truly be a globalised production. That's the kind of the image of it. And, you know, to some extent, some of that did happen. But all of this, you know, all these facts and figures are just important, I think, because they give us an idea that this idea of globalisation is based on things that aren't really happening. But probably the key thing is this idea of multinationals and the movement of capital, because one of the central ideas of the common sense of globalisation is that multinationals can move their capital whenever they want and thereby are able to thwart attempts by governments to control them or attempts by workers to improve wages and conditions. Now, there's a central confusion, I think, in this idea about the movability of capital. It's a confusion between different sorts of capital, because obviously it's very easy for firms which trade internationally to move money around internationally. You know, electronic transfers, you know, blink of an eye, it's done, and so on. But moving money, this is not the only form that capitalism takes. It's not the only form of capital, and moving money is a very different thing to moving productive capital. When you think of productive capital, you think of factories, think of mines. They're pretty immovable. There's a whole series. I'm sure you put your minds to it, you come up with a whole range of examples of productive capital that simply can't be moved in anything like the way that financial capital can be. Now, sometimes a firm can move its machinery and equipment, but it's difficult, and before it can be operated somewhere else, the firm's got to recruit or train a sufficiently skilled workforce, and while they're trying to do that, not only does the investment in the old buildings have to be written off, there's no return on the investment in the machinery either. And let's not forget, we're talking about capitalism here, profit reigns supreme. The desire to move elsewhere is motivated by profit. It's got to be profitable to do it. And there are a whole series of things that profitable production needs. We generally call them infrastructure. And so in order to be able to produce at whatever is the competitive rate of their industry and so on the world level, they need a certain infrastructure. They need sources of raw materials. They need a labour force with the right level of training. They need reliable electricity and water supplies. They need a trustworthy financial system, friendly bankers, a road and rail network, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And multinationals don't just throw these assets away and hope to find them in some other place in the world because labour is slightly cheaper or governments are slightly more cooperative. That there's got to be a balance there of how we're going to make money out of doing this. And productive capital simply can't be footloose. Again, we've got plenty of statistical evidence of US capital. Well, US capital is a good example because it's the biggest. Very, very low propensity to move. Between 1977 and 2006, if you compare domestic and overseas operations of US multinationals, there's hardly been a change over that 30-year period. But what about job losses and the movement of capital? I think once we start to undermine the idea that capital can just go anywhere it likes, just sort of up sticks and say, oh, sorry, you asked for a wage rise, that's right, we're leaving, and so on, that this argument, I think, is one of the key ones, because the claim that the movement of capital to less developed countries in search of lower labour costs has been the main cause of rising unemployment in the advanced countries is a very widespread one, and it's totally wrong. It's totally untrue, not borne out at all by the facts. Now, the pattern of investment by multinationals does not provide a picture of massive investment in cheap labour countries at the expense of jobs in the advanced countries. Quite the opposite. The bulk, as I noted before, the bulk of foreign direct investment by multinationals is in the advanced industrial countries. It's in those countries where the wage levels tend to be the highest. And this is for the simple reason that the multinationals have found that these are the most profitable countries to invest in. Very simple. Those figures I gave before for US stability, the shift between domestic and international production hardly moving over 30 years, have indicated that investment and employment in the domestic economy in the US have kept pace with investment overseas. As the US economy has expanded, it hasn't expanded further overseas. And what is more, the developing countries that have witnessed a lot of developing countries have had very little in the way of international investment. But those developing countries that have witnessed some surge of investment have not in general been those with the lowest wages. So most of the poorest continent, which is Africa, stagnates. And in fact, Africa overall has experienced for decades now a net outflow of capital. Growth has increased at a relatively rapid rate in countries like South Korea. And South Korea's wage rates are not much lower than Britain's. There's other evidence as well which proves the same point. Because you think if the cause of unemployment in the developed economies is capital's ability to just up stakes and go offshore and all those things that we read about time and time again, then we should expect that the kind of jobs where unemployment is the highest are those that are most movable. And yet, you look at where unemployment has hit, what industries, they're not these kind of industries. They're jobs like construction, newspaper printing, the waterfront, the public service, postal work, telecommunications, the disposal of rubbish, and a host of others, all of which cannot be done somewhere else. They have to be done locally for obvious reasons. And so when we look at loss of jobs in these industries, then we have to find an explanation that's not so kind to capitalism. We have to find an explanation that's not just, oh, well, they just went somewhere else. Actually, it can only be due to firms seeking to raise profits by cost-cutting and new technology on the one hand and recessions on the other. So, yeah, just one final figure. I think that sometimes the figures help to kind of make it a bit clearer. More capital has come into the US than has gone out since 1980, and yet 4 million manufacturing jobs were lost in that time in the United States. So the idea that capital is going elsewhere, that somehow, and you see the xenophobic implications, that somehow some other workers who aren't American are getting these jobs, actually the 4 million manufacturing jobs lost during that time cannot be accounted for by this. I'll say a little bit about multinationals and states. I was going to say, well, I'll dispense entirely because I'm running late, aren't I?
Too bad.
Okay, I'm running a bit late. I think I'll dispense entirely with talking about war because it's too bloody obvious, isn't it? Yeah, the role of the state wars. Yeah, General Motors doesn't go to war for themselves. They don't have their own army. The United States state provides it for them and all the other corporations within their borders. So war is a way, you know, war is one of those things where the role of the state really can't be denied. But there, I think there are a range of other things about multinationals and states which, again, undermine all the credibility of this idea that globalisation now means that the world is a kind of even more dog-eat-dog, nasty capitalist place where no one can do anything about anything except endure it. So the globalisation argument assumes that capital is increasingly dispensing with the services of a national state, and yet we see a number of things. Firstly, the majority of multinationals continue to concentrate most of their production within one state, or at least within one state and its close neighbours, as I said before. Secondly, even the investment which does flow towards cheap labour locations outside the advanced countries doesn't just flow willy-nilly anywhere. It doesn't flow completely independently of the operations of the home state. And one of the things I think that illustrates this is that multinationals from each of the major states tend to concentrate their third world and newly industrialising country investment and sales in particular regions of the world. And which regions would they be? They would be regions of the world where their home state exercises influence. And so German capital flows to Eastern Europe, French to Central, Western and Northern Africa. The French are amongst a few of the OECD countries actually doing any investing in Africa. And you think about the places they invest, all have French as one of their languages. Why would that be? And the US, obviously, to certain countries in Latin America, Japan to the Pacific, Australia to the South Pacific, and so on. In other words, that the state and the military of these countries have an influence over where the investment takes place. Thirdly, the state continues to play a key role in establishing and maintaining many key firms. With economic crisis, as we're in at the moment, a whole series of firms have been saved by their respective governments. On top of this, many firms depend for major contracts on governments. defence industry is an obvious example. The oil industry and US Middle East hegemony, currently very much under threat. Yes, those sorts of things. In Australia, the National Broadband Network, a major profit-making operation, very much dependent on the Australian state. And the final thing, I think just to illustrate this point, is that while currencies have been free to float since the end of the Bretton Woods Agreement, they've been able to float in value in relation to each other, but they don't really float, do they? That it's not some free market and there's no state intervention. We have these things called central banks. They buy currencies. They help to move things up and down in order to assist the corporations within their borders. And so the result is that currency levels are very much dependent on negotiations between governments or central banks rather than just on some, you know, imaginary market forces. Only a few firms, in other words, can operate in a borderless world. Governments, both host and home, continue to play a crucial role and perhaps paradoxically an increasing role. And so we're not looking really at a world of non-national capitals, far from it. So the refutation of the globalisation theory should lead to a very different view of the way in which the world system is going. It's one which is characterised by international conflicts and war, as well as by uncontrollable economic crises. Different firms have different interests and will look to the individual states over which they have influence to try and achieve these. So to try and summarise so far, the system is international, but this is nothing new. Firms will seek out the most profitable sites internationally for production, but this doesn't mean that they're footloose and able to abandon existing sites at a moment's notice, nor does it mean that they will always go where the labour is the cheapest. There is a tendency to restructure production across national boundaries, but this doesn't prevent multinationals relying on national and regional bases. Capitalist states are restricted in their ability to control the working of the system they support, but this does not mean they are irrelevant to it. So, what political conclusions flow from all of this? Well, hopefully it's clear now that the political conclusions, not just of the neoliberal boosters of capitalism about this is the way the world is and no one can ever resist capitalism ever again, you know, ideas that got a massive boost with the Francis Fukuyama's great statement about the end of history because, you know, Stalinism was dead, and therefore instead of state capitalism being a rival to private capitalism in the West, we now had a situation where Western capitalism was it. So those people's arguments, I think, not based on reality, but also the pessimistic arguments of those who said, well, really, there's nothing you can do now. As soon as you say boo to them, they'll be offshoring and taking your jobs with them. That those arguments are not based on anything that's actually really happening. But there are other political conclusions that can flow from this. In the first round of this globalisation argument in the 1990s, there are a number of books written by people who were social democrats, academics, but people who saw themselves as social democrats. They were reformists. They wanted to reform capitalism. They were sincere in their hatred of the depredations of international capitalism, but they wanted to do a job, and they did a good job. People like Hurst and Thompson wrote an excellent book in the 1990s that went through using figures that were current at that time to indicate that the globalisation that people were talking about wasn't happening. As I said, all of those figures now make the case even more strongly. So Hurst and Thompson in the 1990s drew a number of conclusions that they argued that what was needed was piecemeal reform. They could see that there were problems with the way that capitalism was operating, that they believed, because they didn't believe the globalisation theories that said that states can't do anything, and they were reformists, therefore they believed that governments could bring order to the economy through a slight adjustment of the traditional techniques. All that was required in their argument was for these governments to extend their present economic summits into more systematic cooperation. And if only the US, Japan and the European Union would lay down rules for the money markets and direct investment, the resulting governance, as they called it, would begin to bring the system to order. And then other national governments, and within them provincial and urban authorities, would be able to orchestrate consensus in which, and these are their words, Chris Harmon quotes them, I'm just quoting him, orchestrate consensus in which the different factors of production relate to each other in other than just market terms, that is, labour and management and capital providers and firms. So if only that all the various, you know, it's classic pluralism, isn't it? If all the various interest groups could just get together and work out how to make things better. The economic summits, however, didn't turn out like this. Those various G20s, G8s, G7s, whatever numbers we're up to now, the economic summits show no signs of being able to regulate the world economy. And of course, since Hurst and Thompson wrote their book, we've had the global financial crisis and everything that's flowed from it. So the economic summits don't show any signs of being able to regulate the world economy, still less to turn it in a rational direction. In fact, again, as Chris Harman puts it, they are in fact horse trading sessions in which the rival governments push the interests of the rival firms connected to them. They take concerted action when their interests happen to coincide, for example, when it comes to opening up some other country for their joint exploitation, or when the most powerful of them, the US, succeeds in browbeating the others into accepting its hegemony. More often than not, however, it is not concerted action that results, but a failure to agree. And I could only think of the Copenhagen summit when he said that. So while the globalisation theorists believe there's been a radical change which has taken such power away from states, Hurst and Thompson, on the other hand, and they're empirically much more correct, but their conclusion isn't. They believe that states still have that power if only they could bring themselves to use it. But it's not a mere lack of willpower on the part of reformist governments, because they're trapped by the whole logic of reformism itself, which involves trying to make the system work, and that means subordinating their policies to the demands of capital accumulation. The whole project of, you know, everyone who wants to reform capitalism is the state, you know, the whole idea, the state's neutral. Yeah, well, it just happens that the state's not neutral. The state is there to operate in the interests of capital, and its project is to assist the organisation and the demands of capital accumulation. And reformist governments can't cope with the economic crisis because they accept the constraints of the system. They're willing to leave the major means of production in the existing hands of capitalists, and insofar as they attempt to limit the power of capital, things like exchange controls, regulation of investment, public expenditure programs, not that they have many public expenditure programs these days, mostly public cuts, but they do so from the top down through the existing state machines, which are built on the assumption of collaboration with capital, not opposition to it. And they're dominated at the top by those who identify with the interests of capitalists. It's just the ABC of the Marxist analysis of the state, something that obviously is a massive stumbling block to the idea that the state can somehow domesticate capitalism. In the reformist perspective, there is no place for the direct action of workers from below. And yet, it's precisely such action which, if coordinated across the economy, can prevent actions by capital, like movements of capital abroad, closures of factories, hoarding of necessities, whatever it is, that are designed to sabotage attempts to improve the condition of the mass of working people. And it's such actions that can then go further to put the means of production to work in ways designed to satisfy need and not the drive to profit. So my final point is to talk about the global economy and the power of workers. I think the important point here is that the changes in capitalism that conveniently go under the name globalisation do not make an attempt at a revolutionary breakthrough by the working class qualitatively more difficult. And I think that's important. If all this stuff that was said about globalisation were true, the whole project of workers' revolution would have become more difficult. Fortunately for us, none of it's true, and therefore the project remains as achievable as ever. Because it's not only reformist governments which are seen to be powerless according to the globalisation consensus. It also argues that workers too have much less ability to stand up to the dictates of capital than they did in the past. And so it's a whole argument really about the futility of workers fighting for improvements in wages or working conditions within the existing system. Because after all, if you do that, you'll lose your job, they'll go offshore, you know, the arguments that I've made already. And so the argument is that any attempt by workers to seriously impose their demands on capital will simply lead to it ignoring them and, if necessary, going elsewhere in the system. But there's two points to be made about this. One, the point I've laboured probably enough, the capital's not footloose and it can't just nick off. But secondly, that the very international integration of production that has been part of these changes increases the bargaining power of particular groups of workers. And I think you can see, you know, I'll go back to the world car, even though it wasn't quite as world as they said it was going to be, the fact that components of cars are often made in a range of different countries and so on now means that the makers of the workers who make the seatbelts, for example, in one country in Europe may well be able to hold up the production of all cars elsewhere in Europe at the assembly point, simply because those component parts are now internationally spread out. They're not available anywhere else, and therefore the bargaining power, the strategic power of some groups of workers actually has been increased by this process. So to conclude, workers have suffered internationally many defeats over the last decades. There's no denying that. But very few of them have been because capitalism has simply been able to pack its bags and move elsewhere. Usually they have been because firms have been able to keep production going in existing plants or sometimes in new plants in the same country as they fought against the unions. As the American socialist Kim Moody points out, union leaders in the States have convinced their members that jobs have gone overseas when in fact at least half of them just moved down the interstate. And so American capitalism, in other words, has been moving the jobs, not offshoring, not going somewhere else, but moving to places where levels of union organisation were less, taking advantage of whatever advantage you could get out of the state of the class struggle in the United States. And capital has been winning. And I think the phrase that our comrade from the US, Sean Harkin, has used a number of times, talking about the last 3 or 4 decades in the United States as the one-sided class war, that one-sided class war that's starting to come to an end as we saw at Wisconsin. But why capitalism has been winning that one-sided class war in the US over those last few decades has been not because it was footloose, not because it could relocate at the drop of a hat, but because it fought ruthlessly while the union leaderships preached moderation and respectability. The globalisation idea, not the reality, there is no reality, but the globalisation idea, this idea that you can't do anything, there is no alternative, that idea has been used by bosses to threaten plant closures, but not necessarily to do them. Again, there's some fascinating figures in Kevin Dugan's book, New Capitalism, where he talks about statistics that various academics have put together of plant closures during union negotiations, and then how many of those plants actually closed afterwards. They closed down the plant during the union negotiations in order to strengthen their bargaining position, and then when they got what they want, less than 5% of them actually closed. So this is a whole argument. The idea of globalisation has been used not just by our enemies. It's been used by the Labour lieutenants of capital inside the union movement, if you like, the people that the trade union bureaucracy and so on, who've argued that there's nothing we can do, we've got to be reasonable, we've got to try and find negotiations, all those sort of arguments. So this argument about globalisation is not one that's just outside the working class movement. It's been used by bosses to threaten plant closures, but it's also been used by the leaders of the working class movement, by the union leaders, to say, well, we can't really do anything. So globalisation of production did not play a significant role in enabling the employers to win any of these disputes, but the ideology of globalisation has played a role. It's encouraged the idea that multinationals are too powerful to be hit by old-fashioned forms of worker struggle, and it's the abandonment of these forms of struggle that's actually handed victory to the multinationals.